This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello and welcome. This is Colleen O'Grady, the host of the Power Your Parenting Moms with Teens podcast. This is a gathering place for moms to be encouraged, nurtured, and inspired. Also, you'll learn the latest in teen research and trends and get practical parenting tips. You really can improve your relationship with your teen and enjoy the teenage years. Welcome back, everyone, to the 118th episode of Power Your Parenting Moms with Teen podcast. I'm Colleen O'Grady, the host of the show. Any moms have juniors or seniors about to go to college or even college students? I have a great tool for you today. Moms, you know more than anyone that one of the biggest challenges your teen is going to face when they go to college is self-management, managing what they eat, managing alcohol, managing stress, managing sleep, managing relationships and exercise and balancing their time. A lot of times, moms, we worry about our teens getting good grades and going to class, but we don't worry about their health. Many moons ago, I was a resident advisor for 2 years, and then I was an associate head resident for a freshman girl dorm, 400 girls, for 3 years. Add to this, I've been talking to college students for 25 years, and I've heard many stories about college students not managing their health well, which is why I ended up seeing them in my private practice. And I love college students. I actually do. And I have two wonderful guests today, and you're going to love them. Jill and Dave Henry met coaching high school sports in Los Angeles and have been working with teens for nearly 15 years. With every graduating class, they fielded their student athletes' concerns about the transition to college. Determined to help, the Henrys decided to leverage their combined professional skills in research, study design, data analysis, and storytelling. Jill is a veteran statistics teacher, and Dave is a Peabody Award-winning TV and film editor, to create a fun yet informative resource with the goal of preparing all students to enjoy college without sacrificing their health. Their book, The Greatest College Health Guide You Never Knew You Needed, How to Manage Food, Booze, Stress, Sex, Sleep, and Exercise on Campus, was just published. So welcome, Jill and Dave Henry. I'm so glad you're here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Yes. And is it true that you have recently written a book?
We have. It just came out on June 1st. It was supposed to come out April 20th, and then it got pushed again to May 11th and finally June 1st. But it's here after, man, nearly 5 years of being in the works. And so we're so excited to finally be able to hold it and share it and talk about it.
All right.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So can you tell the moms who are listening the title of the book?
Yeah, this is called The Greatest College Health Guide You Never Knew You Needed. And the reason we wrote this book was we found such a disconnect between information landing with high school students that they need in terms of how do I take care of myself now that I'm on my own. So that was the impetus for this adventure.
Yes. So how about personally, why did y'all write this book? Like, what was it about you personally, your life, that you said, you know what, we should do this?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this all started fall of 2016. I coach high school cross country. Dave used to coach high school football. That's actually how we met. And I've been a high school math teacher for 14 years now. So I have a lot of experience working with teenagers. And the last race of our cross country season, one of my runners came up to me. She was a senior. It was her only sport of high school. So the last race, the end of it meant sports were done for her forever. And she came up to me with tears in her eyes and asked me, "Coach, how do I not get in the freshman 15? And was completely panicked about this new reality that high school sports, which had kept her taking care of herself, particularly cross country, which is so body driven, like how you eat and sleep and recover is all going to impact how you perform. And so just having that sport had kept her taking care of herself. And so she was starting to accept this new reality of all of those decisions were on her. And she was looking ahead to the fall when she was losing all the structures, the next fall rather, she was losing all the structures that currently existed for her. She didn't even know where she was going to college yet, but we talk about the media talks about, you know, this common conversation is about the freshman 15. And so that's what a lot of female students in particular find themselves really worried about. So I promised to help. Included Dave. And we started doing research to help prepare these kids. And I think initially we thought it might be more focused on like how to navigate the dining hall and how to, you know, incorporate exercise, but that's so limiting. And I think the bigger issue is not how do you avoid the freshman 15? It's how do you take care of yourself now that all of these decisions that impact how you feel are your responsibility for the first time ever. And so that's really why we took on the project. And I think we felt comfortable writing it because of our experience with teenagers, because as coaches, we do a lot of health education in our programs. And also we wanted to root the entire book in storytelling. And we'd done some writing together about the failures that we'd experienced on our own vacations. And so there had already been some, you know, sort of joint writing, about our own tales. And we certainly had plenty to draw from when looking back on college. Yes. So it was an easy way into the book.
And when we first came back to the kids, we had a team dinner for this whole cross country class, this first year of students that kind of came to Jill and said, "What are we going to do?" And we said, "Look, we'll give you a pamphlet, but like, there's so much information here. You could write a whole book about this." And it was one of the students that looked to us without flinching and said, "You should do it."
Yeah. Wow.
And that was like, I'll never forget that moment. Yeah, I'll never forget either. Where I was standing. I'll never forget like where she was standing. And that was the kind of light bulb moment for us that there's something here that's missing. So let's do it.
Yes. As you know, I am a therapist, a marriage and family therapist. I have worked in the adolescent department at University of Texas and have done clinics. And I've been in the Harris County Psychiatric Center and I have seen adolescents there. I did youth ministry for 10 years. I have been an RA when I was in college, and I was associate head resident when I was a few years older than them for 400 freshman girls for 3 years.
That's quite a position to be in.
So I can tell you that as I am looking through your book, it's the thing. It's the thing that these kids need. And it is easy to read. It's full of great information. It's written for a college student because you throw some curse words in there to make it interesting. But it's information. It's probably some of it they know, but they don't want to really be paying attention to it.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. What we found was that this information, there's no shortage of it. It's easy to find online. We did a whole lot of research and dug into some really legit studies to try to put the best of what's available in there. But every college has a website that's dedicated to wellness. I think what we felt was missing was any infusion of personality and the comprehensive package where you could start from cover to cover and learn everything you needed to know to help you take care of yourself. And so we really felt like there was somewhat of a hole in what was available for kids. Because we originally, to help, didn't necessarily intend to write a book. We were hoping to find a book to give. And what we realized was that there wasn't anything like this on the market, neither, you know, for high school or college students, but just in general, sort of a comprehensive health guide that covered more than diet and exercise, but that covered again, the entire spectrum of health, the physical, the mental, the emotional.
And it's not to say that, you know, facts and studies aren't important. Of course they are. You know, to have the experts weigh in and say, this is what you should be doing. You need to have those kind of outlets, right? But when you get a pamphlet from a doctor that says, when you have the flu, you should do this, and then you should do this, that's not the same as reading a story from a freshman at a big university that says, I got mono and I was so destroyed for months and I had to drop out of school and then come back the next month. Already you're leaning in because you're relating to an experience and you're taking valuable health information, but you're rooting it in a story that makes it personal, that attaches a human being to it. And it was always that side of using an angle to come at this information, rooting it, not just in our own personal experiences and failures, but that would also be relatively limiting, right? But incorporating as many college student voices as possible so that the information, again, is rooted in a human being, but also being enforced as you're going by a sophomore from a big state school or a senior from a small private school, somebody on the West Coast, somebody in the East Coast. And cumulatively, there's this feeling of, I'm a part of all of this.
Yeah.
This is a group trying to learn how to take care of ourselves rather than the judgment of, here's the expectation. And if you're not living up to it, you're doing something wrong. So those were really important tonal guiding forces for us in trying to put this together.
Yeah, I would agree. Like, you have quotes from all these different college students. It almost, the book felt like kind of a college forum, like a group of kids talking and someone goes, man, I really effed up. This is how this impacted me. And it was like real talk from college students while giving them some really great info. So I really loved that. What are some of the stories that you heard that really impacted you?
I think that one, that student from Tufts.
Yeah, there was a sophomore from Tufts. There's two that really stand out to me. And one was a student who was really worried that she was going to be peer pressured into doing something she didn't want to do, which was drinking. And she was scared that once I got to college, I'd be in a situation where somebody would force me to drink. And I didn't want to do that. And she said, the first time I said no, everybody around me was so receptive. And people, it wasn't a big deal at all. And it was like this enormous exhale kind of gasp, aha moment for her of empowerment that I can say this and nobody's like out there scheming to try and get me to drink, right? They don't care. And again, that message coming from a peer rather than coming from a parent or a teacher or even a coach saying you can always stand up for yourself and you can always, you know, that doesn't have the same power as somebody communicating fear and vulnerability and then what they found and what they learned.
Yes.
And that always had so much power to me. There was one more that really stands out too, and it had to do with procrastination. And this student who was a senior said, looking back, every time I had to get something done, the only thing that was stopping me was me feeling bad about myself because I hadn't done it already. It was that anger pressure of like, what's wrong with you? Why can't you do this? And as corny as it sounds, forgiveness for them was the solution, that having to let themselves off the hook a little bit and say, okay, well, you didn't do it yet. That's okay. You're here right now. So do it. And every time it was like, they opened a gate at a horse race and they were like, okay, now I'm going to write the paper. Now I'm going to do the thing. And again, those messages coming from students have a weight and a connection potential that just isn't the same if it's somebody who's talking down to you or telling you what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think what blew us away about the survey. So just to back up, to collect all of these student quotes, we designed with help of a psychologist, a really detailed survey. And my background is in statistics. So this was really fun for me. Snowballed it out, randomized it, and then sort of snowballed it out. And we got probably 1,000 responses. And this was spring semester in April. So these kids, they were probably procrastinating doing this survey, but
they did it.
And the responses that we got, and no joke, I think individual kids probably took 30 minutes writing their responses because they had this wealth of insight that they wanted to share about their struggles and about their successes and what they would advise somebody else to do differently. And so overall, I mean, every topic in the book, because we talk about food and alcohol and exercise and stress, and in stress, we talk about relationships and finances, and then we talk about sleep and habits. And every single chapter had these really profound, powerful quotes from kids owning up to decisions they made that weren't the best for them. And they came out on the other side, but sharing heavy stories of sexual assault and suicidal ideation and eating disorders and things that we know are issues from statistics, but the human element of it is sometimes missing from the education. And so it was really powerful for us going through those quotes the first time and realizing that we had this incredible opportunity to share these stories and of students teaching each other. And like you said, I think one of the kindest reviews we've gotten and one that's really meant a lot to us is from a student reader saying that it really feels like a community. Like you use the word forum and feeling like you're learning from the tales of other people and that it really does lack judgment and like from a top-down type of educational tool. And we're really proud of that. And I think the students are really to thank because I don't think the book would have had nearly the same potential for sort of profoundly positive outcomes had students not taken the time to weigh in.
Yeah. Yeah. So how about, as you're doing the preparation for this book, statistics that you went, oh my gosh, did you have any surprising statistics?
For sure. The National College Health Assessment was sort of a treasure trove of insight for us. That's a yearly survey that's done. Schools can opt into it, and it's pretty lengthy. It's a lot of multiple choice questions. And so it's not ours when we sent our survey was an open response. This does not, I don't think it offers that option. So it's a lot of students just checking the boxes. And one of the questions that really blew us away was essentially, you know the statistic, it was 88%.
Yeah, so the question was, in the last year, yeah, have you felt tremendous pressure? Yes or no? And 88% of college students said yes. And of those 88%, 60% said, oh, I felt that within the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And so this recognition of a situation that these young people find themselves in, which is a combination of what the outside world is telling me, what I need to be doing or how I need to look or what success feels like, and this internal pressure of it costs a lot of money to be here.
Right.
Maybe I'm not doing very well. Maybe I'm not finding a lot of friends. That is just this pressure cooker.
Right.
That there needs to be an outlet and there needs to be a place for people to feel safe in talking about this and in hearing from other people so that they know I'm not alone in this, right? Because those statistics are powerful, but they can just be reduced to numbers on a page. And if you hear it and you're shocked and you're like, wow, that's crazy. And then you go back to scrolling and you keep moving on. It's not sinking in the same way.
Well, and you know, I'll jump in here because I just realized something that I never really put into context before. That survey goes into why they struggle. And kids are all over the map with it. Majority feel a lot of pressure because of academics, but close to that feel the same amount of pressure because of finances or personal appearance or intimate relationships. And so all of these things, we talk so much about stress and it's such a topic in the media of kids are stressed and college students are overwhelmed. But I think what that survey really gives a lot of light to is it's for a variety of different reasons. Not all kids are struggling from the same thing. And that means there's not a one size fits all solution. And so the grounding thing is like, they just need to be, and actually I'll cite this. One of the things that we open the book with is a study that was done on a college campus, and it looked at why kids struggle. And the bottom line was that they lack the knowledge to effectively take care of themselves. So if you connect the dots, it's not to say that they read this book and they're never going to struggle. I think that that's inevitable. That's part of being a human. But because the struggles are so varied, and because it's clear that the education is not really there. As a high school teacher, I know for a fact that's not something we prepare kids for in high school. And colleges typically don't have a ton of time during orientation to really build a foundation of health that's required. But it's so funny if you think about it, all of us are in the position to make decisions that impact how we feel every day. And there's no education for that, which it's like everybody's just kind of like trial and error and surviving and doing the best they can. But it's a really big gap in how we prepare for our adult life. And I think that could, you know, that has a profound impact on how kids are managing during those 4 years of college.
No, that's great. Yeah. And I really like how you got to specifics that stress isn't just about academics. It's a lot of different issues. And yeah. And if you think about how you kind of organized your book, stress is a factor that impacts like eating, alcohol, sleep.
They're all interconnected.
Yeah. They're all interconnected. So let's go to food. So I remember when I went to University of Arkansas and I was going to be that head resident. University of Arkansas has biscuits and gravy.
every meal.
So I just ate a lot of biscuits and gravy. And I don't think in undergrad I gained the 10 or 15, but yeah. Is the biscuits and gravy and just eating yellow and gray food that just put those pounds on. And I did get rid of them the second semester. But what are the trends that you see with college students and kind of eating habits?
It's an interesting question, because from that National College Health Assessment, it's funny that their consumption of fruits and vegetables, which is the main question, it's like how many servings of fruits and vegetables are you eating a day? They're actually not that bad. I think that the issue with college students is all of the other stuff. It's because everything's laid out as a buffet. How do you learn when you have this big, empty, massive plate? How do you learn any sort of portion control? And how do you learn how to be thoughtful about your choices, right? There's going to be biscuits and gravy at every single meal. And so how do you set some ground rules for yourself so that you are using that as, I hate to say reward, but using it as a, you know, more of an often or sometimes or a rarely type choice rather than an everyday. And so I think the data would support that their eating is in some ways healthy, but there's, again, from our survey, you know, there's some conversation in the media about whether the freshman 15 is a myth, and maybe kids don't gain 15 pounds. And I think that's actually less important than talking to the students and them admitting, like, I don't eat great. And whether or not I've gained 15 pounds, and some kids even lose weight, that's so secondary to, I feel like garbage because I'm not eating well. And so the weight thing, I think in our book, we only use the word weight once to recognize the freshman 15, but that's so secondary. And we really tried to give a lot of airtime to how does food make you feel? And how are the choices that you're making about what you're putting in your body impacting your energy and impacting your sleep and your ability to study? And so we really tried to reframe food as, you know, not to dumb it down to just fuel. I think there is an emotional component of what we eat. It should make you happy. Hopefully you enjoy the things you're eating and you should use them as a reward. But also trying to bring some perspective to students to pay attention to how those choices are making your body feel.
And again, it's not like you can completely, by reading a book once, be like, okay, well, I'm forever changed. And now I know I'm only going to eat my greens. I'm going to fuel up every day. And that's how I'm going to live my life because I'm a machine. That's not going to happen, right? But if you begin that conversation with yourself about how does this make me feel? And this could be sleep or lack of sleep. Right. It could be alcohol or lack of alcohol. It could be 4 plates of lasagna at lunch because I love lasagna, right? It's going to make you feel a certain way. And as soon as you can begin that conversation with yourself, and have an understanding of like, I have a super busy day today. I need to just fuel myself. And then I will reward myself at dinner. Right. Or today is Sunday and I don't have to do anything. And we're eating brunch because that's what I like on Sundays. Those decisions can be informed by, well, what do you need to get out of this? You know, if you need to really fuel up, then maybe you don't have a couple of pieces of chocolate cake for lunch, right? That's not going to work out. And it's those kind of conversations that at least beginning to think about them, if that light bulb goes off when they go into a dining hall, you're already winning. Because this is a lifelong thing. Right. It's not like it's just 4 years while you're in college. You got to eat every day.
It's true. Yeah. So I have several things to say to that. Is one is, and I know, you know, y'all know this, but one of the things I think it makes it difficult for their eating is I remember being a head resident and I got in late, like 3:30 in the morning, and it just seemed like it was, you know, noon or something. Yeah. And people are eating pizza. I mean, they're just chowing at right. 3 in the morning. I think you're helping these young people two things. Is you're helping them with self-awareness. Mm-hmm. I can eat unconsciously today, and I'm older than college students. Right. You know, so we all can go unconscious with eating. So you're helping them become more self-aware. And also just in terms of the neuroscience, is they still have those immature brains, and those the reward center of the brain is just like eat, drink, mm-hmm. sex. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, it takes a long time to get to that cortex to kind of go, huh, maybe that's not a good idea. So part of what you're helping them see are what are the real rewards here?
Mm. Yeah.
I'm so glad you said that.
Yeah. We have a whole section about rewards, intrinsic versus extrinsic rewards in the habits chapter. And in talking to students, and I think you have a real point. I think the 3 a.m. eating tends to sort of take the freshman year, you know, by the freshman class by storm. And we don't ever argue in our book that you shouldn't do that. We're like, yeah, those calories that you're drinking after you eat aren't helping you sober up. So if that's why you're doing it, that's a moot point. But to some degree, kids have to experience this stuff to figure out that it doesn't work for them. So we don't in the book say like, don't do it, big mistake. But I think to your point about feeling like it's a reward, it takes students some time to figure out, well, mentally or emotionally, eating at night isn't really worth it, or eating whatever it might be, whether it's eating or exercising, like getting students to pay attention to not the extrinsic reward, the praise that you get from somebody, or the fact that because you worked out, you can have ice cream, the sort of tangible reward. But we were trying to really give more airtime to looking inside. And do you exercise because it makes you feel really proud of yourself? If so, that's awesome. And really try to give some attention to that and do things that make you feel empowered and challenged and, you know, again, proud of yourself for making what you know are good choices. And I think that's really the tool that we've used to try to get kids to think, like you said, to assess their decision-making and try to get them to be more aware of the fact that intrinsic rewards exist and they're more valuable for your health than the extrinsic rewards.
And especially in a world where there's so much that's not within our control and yes. so much of what our input is as a culture, yes. not to blame media and social media and our peer groups, but so much is beyond our control and has the ability to make us feel bad about ourselves. Right. And so understanding and learning for yourself, what are those things you can do for you that are within your control, that at the end of the day, you look back and you're like, you know, I didn't need to do that, but I did it. Mm-hmm. And I feel good that I did it. Mm-hmm. And that's something that when you learn it for yourself, it's like unlocking a secret power. Right.
I agree. Completely agree. So let's talk about booze.
Yes.
Which I kind of like that you use the word booze. I think that's...
we've had a lot of people comment on that.
We've had some people like, do people even call it booze anymore? Like, I don't...
And y'all have to see, moms, you'll have to see the cover of this book because it's very clever. I'll just put the suspense out there.
Sure.
So why do college students need to read about the booze chapter?
Well, first and foremost, half of college students in general are maybe underage. And so we want to be very clear that nowhere in our book are we saying that underage drinking is okay. And you should, because you're in college, you should go drink because now it's free. It's against the law and you can get in a lot of trouble for it. I personally experienced that. but what we do try and broaden the conversation about educating yourself, what does alcohol do to you? How do you find your own personal limits with alcohol? And what is a ceiling that you should never go past? Because things could get scary really fast. Those conversations tend to get lost when it's rooted in just say no, or don't drink until you're 21, because that sentence ends with a period and that's where the conversation stops, right?
Right.
And so it was so important to us to give students the tools to understand that alcohol is a poison. And if you drink too much of it, you will suffer from alcohol poisoning and you can die. And it's not about just using scare tactics to try and open their eyes. It's that right. Some people might not know that.
Yeah.
That kid in the picture at the fraternity who is slamming a bottle of whiskey does not understand that if I do this for too long, I could die tonight, right? Yeah. And so having a conversation about what happens to your body when you drink alcohol, what do you feel at certain stages? And there's a very, very clear tipping point, okay? A lot of people know 0.08 is the limit where you cannot operate a motor vehicle beyond that. Otherwise, you can get a DUI. You can also get a DUI if you have below a 0.08 and the officer believes that you've been impaired. That is true. But there's a really important number at 0.12. And that's when everything that could have been felt as a positive, euphoric experience, a heightening excitement of drinking alcohol, completely disappears and is replaced by dysphoria, is replaced by anxiety and anger. And this also coincides with a real loss of motor skills, of your ability to make proper judgmental decisions, right? And things get really scary, really fast. And so that's why we just felt like we have to have a conversation about this that can be open and can point to it and can use some examples, not just from, you know, my own foibles, right? But from students across the country who, you know, there's this one quote about every year there's ambulances in front of the freshman dorm the very first week of school. That's a powerful sentence, right? Every year, there's somebody who overdid it. And my roommate one year just kept taking shots and all of a sudden was laying on the floor. And people around the room were saying, oh, this happens. She'll be fine.
Right.
And this person was sober, who was observing this, and said, of course, we have to call EMS. We need to get her out of here, because friends were looking at her saying, what do we do? What do we do?
Right.
And that girl blew a 0.38 that night, which if you pull up an alcohol chart online, you can see is very close to entering a coma and is very close to stopping breathing.
Right.
And those kinds of things, if we're able to put them not in coming from a parent or a teacher, but say this happened, we can all look at it and we can talk about it because it's here and it wasn't a child who wasn't living up to expectations from their parent or a teacher saying that they're held to certain standards, but it gives us a story that really happened to respond to. And that's what we really wanted to present in terms of a non-judgmental but informative conversation.
Well, and I'll jump on there and say one more thing we give in the book. You know, we talk about the 0.08 and 0.12, but a lot of students and a lot of adults, honestly, don't have really context for what that translates to in terms of drinks. And so for young women, it's way less than you might think. And so like Dave and I could not go drink for drink, right? Because that's what we talk about in the book, that your gender and your weight have a huge impact on how alcohol is going to impact you and how it's going to affect your BAC. And so, you know, I went to college with, I'd never drank before. And I just thought I'd keep doing it until I like couldn't do it anymore. And so you have no concept of the fact that like, I can only really have three drinks in a night to stay safe and to feel okay the next day. And so we really wanted to provide some context for those numbers and put it in terms of not just the BAC, but like, what does that translate to in drinks? And then how do you keep yourself safe? What are some strategies? If you're going to do it, how do you keep yourself safe? And even if you're not, you're going to be around it. Even on dry campuses, people are finding ways to drink. So it's being prepared like that student whose friend blew a 0.38 to know the signs of danger and knowing like you got to do something about it. And then I think in that story, a lot of kids were afraid to call EMS because they didn't want to get in trouble, and realizing like getting in trouble is such a lesser consequence than having somebody die. And I don't mean to sensationalize it. I think a lot of students, you see it in the news, but but recognizing like it's quite easy to go overboard with alcohol and the consequence is severe. So really just trying to bring attention to that and not, like Dave said, not scare tactic it, but be real blunt about the realities of drinking and the responsibility that that everybody has to try to be safe with it.
Yeah, I would say in that chapter, especially the information you have and the charts you have are super, super helpful. Okay. And I do think even adults were, yeah, blood alcohol, like we forget the numbers, like, oh yeah, I know one is more than the other in terms of alcohol content, but it gets fuzzy in your head.
Right.
And if it's fuzzy in adults, you know, brains, it's going to definitely be fuzzy in college. One thing I'm going to say is I think what makes this difficult is that the culture, the college culture, is binge drinking.
Yeah.
It just is. And like y'all talked about in your chapter, the games and the competition and shots and taking shots. You want to say more about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one thing that's been interesting about looking at statistics over time about binge drinking is that they really haven't changed a whole lot in the last 30 years. And they've hovered around 40% of college students at some point in time during college will participate in binge drinking. And an even more powerful statistic for us was to hear that 28% of college students don't drink at all. And that's not a number that you ever hear about, right?
That's great. Yeah, because, no, you don't.
Because it's everybody binge drinks. And we were just having a great conversation with a student affairs professional at CU Boulder who is saying that every year they do this study about what you think your substance use is and what you perceive your peers' substance use to be, and substance including anything from alcohol to illicit drugs, legal to illegal, anything in between. And every year the numbers are so astronomically higher for what they perceive their peers to be doing versus what their peers are doing based on data that they have and what they themselves are reporting as doing, right? And so yes, we live in a country where drinking is a part of our culture in a way that isn't necessarily as healthy as other places in the world, right? And college drinking specifically has this understanding that it's a binge drinking situation. And it's not to discount that it doesn't happen. That's how I learned to drink. And that's how I found a brick wall that I went right into, right? But that not everybody is doing that is a really important message for kids to hear, because A, you want to make sure that if you're going to participate, that you can do that safely and that you can take care of the people around you and you can make sure that you're not in a situation where other people will be dangerous to you. All of those things are true, right?
Yes.
But not everybody is standing up on a table doing shots and taking off their shirts and you know, like that. That is a stereotype, and that does exist in the world, but that is not everybody's experience of college. And especially if you're scared about being put in a position like that, you can find your people. They won't be in a basement somewhere with sticky floors, you know.
That's great. So one of the things I appreciated is that you talked about consent and intoxication, because I have seen that multiple times and recently have talked to one of my clients who was a virgin, blacked out, and she had all the shame and she didn't know, she felt shame about it. And I said, did you black out? And she said, I did. I said, do you remember anything of it? I don't. And she had no idea that that wasn't okay, that that was a rape. She had no idea. So I think there are a lot of girls that don't know that. And I think because of their own shame about it, they don't talk about it. And I'm wondering what y'all see about that.
The rates for it are really sobering. It's like 1 in 5 suffer a sexual assault in college. And we put it in the booze chapter because I don't remember the statistic off the top of my head. It's over 50% of these encounters happen while one or the other person is intoxicated. And so there's a real link between alcohol usage on college campuses and these sexual assaults. And we had somebody we know, and this, you know, a lot of the people who did the survey, we didn't know, but they were completely anonymous. And this was somebody, though, that's really close to us, who was in college at the time we were writing and was sexually assaulted by a friend who was sober and she wasn't. And she wrote a really powerful testimonial for the book that's inside of it. And every time I read it, it's, you know, it's both very empowering and I think brings some real humanity to the issue. And she was very brave to write it. But it's an issue. I mean, I have a Google Alert on my phone so that I can sort of pay attention to the prevalence of these sexual assaults on college campus and how often they're being talked about. And it's a daily thing, different campuses all over the country. And, you know, Dave really beautifully talked about this in the alcohol chapter. And I don't know that, you know, he said we could write a whole book about why these things happen. The bigger issue is people need to, boys, men and women need to understand very clearly what consent is. And you want to talk about that?
And just so frequently too, that the message is distilled down and it's wrong. The message is wrong that because you drank this much, this is your fault. And that needs to be thrown in the garbage.
Right.
And whoever wrote that needs to stand up and we can all yell shame at that person, right?
I'm with you.
This is a problem that is complex and it involves every single person on that campus in terms of raising their awareness level of at certain times of night, at certain levels of intoxication. We see the numbers that this happens at such a higher rate. And so it's not on a girl to make sure she doesn't drink too much. It is 100% on a guy to make sure that I'm never putting somebody in that position, regardless of what signals I think I may or may not be given, that getting verbal consent from someone is a requirement. It doesn't have to be a turn off. It has to be part of building a trust situation. And most importantly, it's also the people who are around. Mm. Because if you're going out with your friends and you see your friend and somebody's hanging on him in a way that just doesn't feel right, that's on you right now, your moral compass, to say, I need to do something about this. And that goes for I'm not talking about a girlfriend who sees a girlfriend. I'm talking about the guys who see my buddy, who I know when Jack drinks a lot, Jack gets a little crazy. Jack looks crazy right now and his eyes are a little bloodshot. And I need to make sure he doesn't do something stupid tonight and he doesn't hurt anybody. And that it's difficult to navigate a conversation like this with nuance, where there are some pretty clear black and whites in terms of a moral ground of what is acceptable, what is unacceptable behavior. But in the way that you can communicate this, it can be vague and it can be gray. And the more that we have these conversations on campuses, the more awareness can be brought to this.
That's beautifully said. That's really, really important. Well, we could talk about 1 million things here. So I know that this book is going to be a book that every mom listening is going to want their seniors to read. Like, how do they get them to read it? Or do you find that seniors want to read this book?
Great question. I think once you're in, it's pretty easy to fly through. And I think we really tried to pay a lot of attention to, again, like we said earlier, rooting this in stories. And so I think this book nicely rides this balance between being a reference guide that you could go highlight and come back to over and over again as a student. But more importantly, for the student perspective, a real story that you can read from beginning to end. And we had one student weigh in that's like, yeah, sure, this is a health guide, but it doesn't feel that way. It's funny and you know, you can go from cover to cover and finish and be completely surprised by how much you've learned. And I think that's a real asset about it. And so what we've heard from parents is that when they've read it, oftentimes I'll say it this way, they've read it alongside their kids. And it's been a really great way to get into a conversation that would have otherwise maybe been a parent tiptoeing around how to bring up something like consent. But because of the book, they now have this entry point into a conversation. And so I think that if students find it and learn about it and get into it, we've had people say within the first two pages, I was hooked. Because it is so driven by these tales of failure, which I think in often cases are pretty fun to read about. And so it's just about getting into the hands of the kids. But I think once it's there for everybody, I think it really transcends generational boundaries, because I think students get as much out of it as parents, as, you know, people in their mid 30s, like we are. So it's, again, I would highlight the fact it really feels like a story, like something you would read from the beginning, not something you'd flip through and try to get the piece you needed.
And if you're a parent trying to convince your child this is a good idea, a quick sell is that it's funny.
Yeah.
This will make okay. you laugh.
Okay.
Like, raw, vulnerable human stories will hold your attention.
Yeah.
And they will change the mood, and they'll keep you engaged. But if you can read the first page and start laughing, you got a chance at keeping them around, right? And that was always the goal from the very beginning, is how do you get somebody who is of an age that may not be interested in reading about health to just keep turning the page and be surprised at, whoa, I just read 17 pages tonight, or whatever it may be. And so tell that to your kids. You'll laugh.
Yeah.
Okay. That's awesome. All right. So on page 215, you have a chart that's the greatest college health practices. So I'm wondering if y'all could give me one in each category. All right. So in the area of food, what's a great college health practice?
I'm going to grab it for you. I think one of the most important things with food is the dessert advice, because I think that's a trap for a lot of kids. So the tip is, replace dessert after lunch with fruit. We had so many kids say that sugar became their new vice when they got to college in the dining hall, because it's always available, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so just finding ways to swap that out, or setting some intentions about, I'm going to only have it at dinner, felt like we were sort of distilling the piece of advice we got from a lot of students.
And I'll add one more to that too, that I think is a good one, in that, If you're looking to change it up, because maybe it's second semester and you got spring break coming up, and the first semester put 12 pounds around your waistband and you're trying to do something about that, try not indulging 2 days in a row. So you can eat ice cream at night. Try not to do that again tomorrow. And just a little change up there will help kind of put these practices of self-discipline in place.
Awesome. There's alcohol. This is fun. We haven't looked through this and given these tips in a while.
All right, booze.
Yeah, for booze, you need to understand what your ceiling is. And when I say ceiling, I mean a limit that you cannot drink this amount of drinks in a certain amount of time. Otherwise, you're going to be in trouble. And you can look this up on a BAC chart. It's based on your gender and your weight. There's some other factors that come into place, but just those two alone will give you a really strong baseline of understanding it. Like, whoa, at my weight, I can never have three drinks within an hour. And a lot of people don't know that. And because when you first have a drink and you feel a little bit of this euphoria, then do you want to have another one is a great idea.
Right.
And then your inhibitions are loosening up a little bit and somebody says, let's have a shot. And now that's a slippery slope right there. So learn your weight, your gender. What is my limit that I can never go past?
Okay. All right. Exercise.
I'm tied here between find a friend and make a schedule, because I think they're both.
Well, you can have two.
Great.
I'll let you have two.
I think the bottom line is you've got to put in some accountability. A lot of students coming from high school have always had exercise taken care of for them by sports. And so that structure and accountability is gone. That's a great thing to practice the summer before you go. I think the easiest way to get both the schedule and the friend, sign up for one of the free fitness classes at the school's gym, because that's a really easy way to go without having to think about anything you're doing once you're there. You just got to show up. And that's a great way to work it in without putting in a lot of effort.
Awesome. Stress.
We've got a lot of tips in there that you can try. And I think it is that trial and error kind of situation that you've got to explore a little bit what works for you. But what I think everybody should have is their emergency call list. Mm-hmm. Put it in your phone, put it in your notes app. Five people, your friends, your family, mentors, teachers, coaches, five people who you could call at any time, because you're going to reach a certain point where the life that you've been building in college sucks. And you're not into it, and you need to break away from it. And just by going on a walk and calling somebody outside of that bubble can do wonders for relieving some of that pressure.
Yes. Yes. And I would also add that exercise is awesome for stress.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. So sleep.
I think this one's going to sound lame to, you know, in parents telling their students this, but set a bedtime. There's a right way to sleep that we learned about when we were doing our research, and it all has to do with sleep cycles. And it's really extensively talked about in the book, but giving yourself an intention as a student about when you'd like to be in bed. Part of that is don't make your room the hangout place so that you have a quiet space to go back to when you're ready to sleep. And ideally you're paired up with a roommate who has similar feelings about when they'd like to go to bed. Some people are just naturally night owls. And so we don't ever argue in the book, you need to be in bed by a certain time, but you should base it off of what you have the next day and try to be consistent. So if you have early classes, I was a math major. We always had 8 a.m. classes. So I couldn't go to bed at 2 a.m. And so really being thoughtful about when your day starts the next day, planning backwards to find a bedtime and being consistent. Sleep across the board was the thing students have come back from this book saying, I knew nothing about that. Mm-hmm. And that has been the hardest part of the college environment for me. So I think that's a chapter that it can make a really profoundly positive impact on your well-being at college for students. Again, like really learning a lot about sleep that they just may not know about. And because we didn't know about much of it, and we've been working on this stuff for years. And so that's a powerful chapter.
Yeah, it is a very powerful chapter. And again, what y'all have done so well is really from a college person's perspective, why this is important for them, not mm-hmm. from a parent's perspective, but like we talked about the intrinsic rewards, like what's in it for them. Mm-hmm. So the whole book is like, what's in it for me? And alcohol looks like it's going to be what's in it for me, but actually, what's in it for me? So it's in a way that they can interact with that information in a new, fresh way.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the one parting idea I have is health on the cover can sometimes get people thinking that it's about how you look. Like I said, this in the beginning, and not about how you feel. We really tried to close out the book by being like, it's just about taking care of yourself. So you can kick some, can I swear? Can I say, so you can kick sure. some ass in life. And right. that's really what we tried to make the point of, like, this isn't about fitting into a certain pant size or being in shape for spring break. It's the bigger macro thing of like, you want to live a life that you're proud of. And part of that is taking care of yourself in a way that you're proud of. And so that's what this whole book is rooted in, is just how do you fulfill how do you be the person you want to be? And that starts from the ground up. How do you treat yourself and your body and care for your mind?
Yeah. Yeah. So Dave, do you have any last advice for our moms who are listening?
There's one specific quick habit that I think is a really interesting thing for kids to try on, right? Because a lot of times they get into college and the structure opens up, they've got way more free time than they had before. So making any decision seems like it's overwhelming or something that they just don't want to do. And a way to cross that bridge with a simple habit of exercise is choose a class that you will wear gym clothes to. Mm. And then as soon as that class is over, you will go right to work out. And that doesn't have to be in the gym. That could be going for a hike. That could be going for a walk. That could be finding a trail. That could be fencing, whatever it is that you want to do. But say that this class at this time, especially in the afternoon, it's a good time to do it. Say, I will show up to that class ready to work out so that as soon as the class is over, I can get right to it.
Well, this has been great advice, and I am sure my moms have loved this. So if they want to contact you or if they want to get your book, and where are you on social media?
Great question. Our book you can find everywhere. So it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, anywhere books are sold. Our website is greatestcollegehealthguide.com. For any moms who are teachers, I'm a career teacher, and we've been working on developing a lot of curriculum to bring this into high schools and colleges. So for those of you that are moms and educators, we have resources for that. And then our social media is lackluster, but it exists, at Greatest College Health Guide. And then our personal one is at Two Coach Henry's, which is just pictures of our cute little kids. So, but that's awesome. Heartwarming. So that's good as well.
And for anybody who's on the fence, who wants to just get like a little bit more of a taste, our website, greatestcollegehealthguide.com, has a great video that walks through a lot of what's in our book, and they can download sample chapters for free. So this isn't something that we're just trying to trick you into. We believe in this information. We know that it helps. So please give it a try.
Well, I want to thank you too for writing this book, because it's going to be really, really helpful. And I think it could save some teenagers' lives. I really do.
So too.
Yeah, we've heard that before. And that's about the greatest compliment you could possibly get when putting things out in the world. So thank you. We appreciate that. Yeah.
You're so welcome. This concludes this week's episode of Power Your Parenting Moms of Teens podcast. If this podcast has been helpful, I would absolutely love it if you could go to Apple Podcasts and give Power Your Parenting Moms of Teens podcast a 5-star review. This makes it easier for other moms like you to find the support and encouragement they need. Also, my best-selling and award-winning book, Dial Down the Drama, Reducing Conflict, Reconnecting with Your Teenage Daughter, A Guide for Mothers Everywhere. You can find that and order it online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble. And you can always find other great resources and contact me at ColleenO'Grady.com, 2 L's and 2 E's.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.